The House Veterans Affairs Committee will come to order, date March 15, 2006. Today we will receive testimony regarding how well the current Montgomery GI Bill is meeting both the service members' needs as well as the needs of our nation. Our witnesses are the leaders of the National Guard and Reserve components whose members benefit from this very important program. The committee's goal for this hearing is to learn what is working and what may need to be changed. At the hearing during which Secretary Nicholson presented the President's FY07 budget, I announced my support for the modernization of the GI Bill and noted that the Partnership for Veterans Education and the Independent Budget had put forth several concepts for our consideration. Since then, my staff and that of Lane Evans' staff have met with key stakeholders to begin the process of designing and moving a bipartisan bill that will meet what I see as two primary goals. First, to make the GI Bill more flexible in the types of education and training available to all eligible veterans. Second, to adjust the program to make it more usable for members of the National Guard and Reserve components while maintaining its value as a recruiting and retention tool. A modernized GI Bill must both help the veteran and the nation. According to the VA, about 30% of our active duty service members never use the GI Bill. VA's usage data on members of the Guard and Reserves is less detailed, but they were paying Section 1606 benefits to about 59,000 as of January 2005, with 81,000 expected to participate this year. The VA says they have about 13,000 applicants for Section 1607 benefits on hand and expect over 50,000 by the end of 2007. Many members do not use their GI Bill, although they have paid their $1,200. Because of even with the current level of benefits, they can't afford to go to college for 4 years while raising their family. This is at a time when the Department of Labor has identified career fields that are critically short of qualified employees. One reason for this disconnect is that the current GI Bill focuses largely on degree-granting programs at the expense of short-term training opportunities that could meet some of these critical shortfalls. My vision of a modernized GI Bill is one that would address both national competitiveness and personal success issues by significantly increasing the number of veterans who use their benefits, and that includes members of the National Guard and the Reserve components. One way I would like to do this is by making it easier for the veteran with a family to get short-term training to qualify for a job in good-paying fields that don't require degrees such as transportation, construction, medical care, public safety, etc. I also want to help members of the Guard and Reserves finish their education after they leave the service if they have not been able to do so while meeting their military commitment. They should not lose their education benefits following such honorable service. Now, this will not be an easy task. You may have heard that an informal estimate of the cost for the concepts being proposed by the Partnerships for Veterans Education was $4.5 billion over 10 years. Some of the cost is due strictly to accounting rules and some due to providing improved education benefits for members of the Guard and Reserves following discharge. I need not remind the officers here and along with the senior executives on this panel that your men and women are no longer the weekend warriors. General Abrams' vision of the total force is now a reality, with the Guard and Reserve forces at full partners in the war on terror. I think it is now time to make them full partners in a modernized GI Bill in a way that meets the needs of the military and the nation. Today I've asked each of you as leaders representing the military forces to help with the heavy lifting. We need to hear whether you think a modernized GI Bill is needed to help you accomplish your mission. This hearing on the GI Bill is the beginning of that process, and the opportunity to give us your candid views will be very much appreciated. I would ask the committee for unanimous consent for an opening statement on behalf of Lane Evans be submitted for the record, along with Stephanie Herseth. Hearing no objections, so ordered. All members are advised if you have an opening statement, it may be submitted for the record. If you would like to to an opening statement at this point. I'll be more than pleased to yield prior to hearing from the panel. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for holding this important hearing today. I know that in my heart and that every member of this committee is eager to start work on modernizing the GI Bill of Rights and the GI Bill for our military men and women. For years, the GI Bill has served our men and women in uniform very well. As a matter of fact, I went to college on the GI Bill. It has helped countless veterans gain access to the higher education system in the country. In fact, like I said, I utilized the GI Bill when I returned home from the Army in the 1970s. The face of our military is changing, as the chairman clearly stated. We are no longer in the reserve and the guard are no longer weekend warriors. And this Congress has had the foresight to make important steps towards recognizing the contributions that the reserve component makes to the force structure of the United States military. In addition to the chapters 1606 and 1607 of Title 10, improve access to the GI Bill benefits for our Guard and reservists. But in my opinion, they do not go far enough. My son just ETS from the National Guard, and he had quite a bit of trouble getting the GI benefits that I think he deserved. I support opening up the GI Bill truly update, modernize, and provide greater flexibility to the educational benefits extended to our military service personnel. I'm eager to work with my colleagues on this committee, our friends on the Armed Forces Services Committee, the Executive Branch, and the military and veteran service organizations to accomplish this important goal. Our men and women have earned the benefits granted to them in the GI Bill. Now it's time to ensure that the benefit reflects the structure of the force that is distributed equitably across the diverse groups that make up our active duty, guard, reserve, and reserve components of the U.S. military. I look forward to hearing your testimony today of the various military branches as well as representatives of the Secretary of Defense. Again, Mr. Chairman, I thank you for holding this important hearing. I think it's critical that we address the needs of our guards and reservists as we have in the past for regular Army or those who are active. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Salazar. Chairman Bozeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate you and Mr. Evans' leadership on this very important issue. I want to remind their members that Ms. Herseth and I will be continuing the fact-finding process by holding a field hearing in Arkansas next week. We'll have several members of the Arkansas National Guard testify, as well as state and federal officials responsible for administering education benefits. We'll also visit the Muskogee Regional Process Office to review how they're handling the claims for education benefits. I'm looking forward to bringing to the committee a bill under the chairman's and ranking members' guidance, a GI Bill that once again will be the premier education benefit in America. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, we will turn to our only panel witnesses today. From left to right, we'll hear from Secretary Tom Hall. He is the fourth Assistant Secretary of Defense for Reserve Affairs and has served in this position since he was sworn in October 9th of 2002. Next, we'll then hear from Mr. Bill Carr. He's the Acting Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Military Personnel Policy. He oversees the recruiting, retention, compensation, and related human resource management for all active duty members of the United States Armed Services. We'll then hear from Lieutenant General James R. Helmley, the Chief of the Army Reserve, Commanding General, U.S. Reserve Command. We'll then hear from Lieutenant General John A. Bradley, the Chief of the Air Force Reserve Headquarters, United States Air Force, Washington, D.C., and Commander of the Air Force Reserve Command, Robbins Air Force Base, Georgia. Next, we'll then hear from Lieutenant General John W. Bergman is the commander of the Marine Forces Reserve, Marine Forces North. We'll then hear from Rear Admiral Craig O. McDonald is the commander of the Naval Reserve Forces Command. We'll then hear from Major General Ronald G. Young, the Director of Manpower and Personnel. He's the J-1 of the National Guard Bureau. In addition, he is currently serving as the Acting Director of the Joint Staff for the National Guard Bureau as of May 1, 2005. And then last, we will hear from Rear Admiral Sally Bryce O'Hara, is the Director of Reserve and Training for the United States Coast Guard. Secretary Hall.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. We don't have a cast of thousands, but we have a cast of seven. So I would ask a couple of requests that all of our written statements be entered into the record.
They will be entered in the record as ordered.
And second, we have discussed and proposed that I give an opening oral statement on behalf of all of us, and then if any of the members wish to say anything of the panel, they can, but I would make a statement and then get right to the questions if that's satisfactory.
Having just taken your recommendation under advisement, what I would will recommend is that we'll hear your opening statement. Dr. Schneider?
I was just hanging on your every word. My first reaction is they have brief written statements. I would expect their oral statements would also be brief, and I think there could be value in hearing from them. I think you're thinking that same way. Yeah.
Well, I took it under advisement for at least 9 seconds.
I was just attempting to save time. We are happy to do
whatever you want. I understand that. Let's go ahead and hear from your opening statement, and then we're going to go right down the line. Each of these officers, I'm sure, have something to say.
Yes, sir.
So we'd like to hear from each of them. Secretary Hall, you're recognized.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for giving us the opportunity to come before you this morning to discuss the Montgomery GI Bill for the Selected Reserve and Reserve Education Assistance Program. The Montgomery GI Bill was established to encourage membership in selected reserve units. It's proven to be an extremely valuable recruiting tool, a highly effective retention tool for the reserve components. Montgomery GI Bill is very well known amongst the reserve component members and has helped the components achieve and maintaining their strength requirements. The fact that a member must continue to serve in a reserve component to maintain eligibility is important and has greatly assisted the reserve components in maintaining consistently high retention rates over the years. It has also obviously increased the educational level of our reserve forces. Between 1984 and 2005, almost 1.5 million selected reserve members gained eligibility for the Montgomery GI Bill entitlement, and nearly 40% have applied for educational assistance. In fiscal year 2005 alone, almost $200 million in benefits was paid to selected reservists. It continues to fulfill its intended purposes, as four of the six Department of Defense reserve components are meeting or exceeding their recruiting goals thus far for 2006. Retention in all of the reserve components is very strong, and overall attrition is very consistent with historic levels. The Reserve Education Assistance Program has been implemented and is working well. As of February this year, almost 14,000 benefit claims have been received and over $1.5 million in claims paid. Ongoing changes to electronic data systems will greatly improve the application process and accelerate the benefit delivery procedures. A joint Department of Defense and Department of Veteran Affairs working group is currently examining the possibility of a total force education benefit that would draw from the best attributes of the two Montgomery GI Bill programs and the REAP. We are actively participating in that forum, and we encourage any discussions that examine overall program performance and identify opportunities for improvements that meets the needs of veterans, reserve component members, and the department. As we work towards program improvement, we need to stress that the veteran and reserve programs were designed for and serve different purposes. Both reserve benefits, the Montgomery GI Bill Selected Reserve and the REAP program, were designed as retention tools to keep members serving in the Guard Reserve. The veteran benefit, although it can be used by someone still serving, was designed to assist members in transitioning to civilian life following service. As we examine the potential for a total force GI Bill, we want to be certain that such a program would encourage continued reserve membership as effectively as the current programs. We should be very careful in changing the basic premise of the Montgomery GI Bill, Selected Reserve, and the REAP. We look forward to working with this committee and the Armed Services Committees of the House and Senate to ensure that these programs remain robust. And I would again like to thank this committee for all you have done for all of our service members. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As Chairman Booyer mentioned, I'm Bill Carr. I represent the active component and the military HR life cycle of recruiting compensation, and of course, an important part of that is the Montgomery GI Bill. If we asked young people today the reason that they would serve in the military or elect to join, it ranges from service and patriotism to an ability to advantage their future. And if you then broke those out, you'd find that considerably more are interested in carefully advantaging their future. The Montgomery GI Bill figures squarely in their decisions. The enrollment rate is 97%, so it's that important to them. The utilization rate for those who complete their obligation and are eligible is 70%. In fact, those who have separated in the past couple of months, 58%. Are already enrolled in some fashion and using their benefits. So the Montgomery GI Bill figures squarely in our recruiting, our retention, and our transition, and has been invaluable to us in manning and sustaining the active force. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. I'm Ron Helmley. I'm an American soldier, and I'm proud to serve in that capacity. Clearly, this hearing comes at an opportune time as we face the first extended duration conflict using an all-volunteer force, both active and reserve component. For the first time since the Korean War, we're mobilizing numbers of reserve component members in an unprecedented way. We're looking at repeat as we look at the, quote, long war, and we have to prepare in a strategic sense for a continuation of that. And we must be always mindful, as Mr. Carr reminded us, that we should not just pile on extra benefits to the extent that we would equal those that entice enlistment and service in the regular components of our various services. So we believe that educational benefits are a major draw for both recruitment and retention. Clearly, Chapter 1606 was a welcome addition, but I'm mindful of the fact that it was added to an existing measure. And that's why I welcome this hearing today and your efforts in this committee to look at this afresh in terms of a total force Montgomery GI Bill that provides important educational benefits for active and reserve component members without just being additive. Lastly, I'd like to point out that one of the frustrations that I've experienced as we've enjoyed such immense support from not only this committee but elsewhere throughout the Congress to support our members is the fact that our policies, practices, procedures, and systems which underpin the authorities this committee and others provide us and the measures you provide us have not kept pace. Thus, as we mobilize soldiers, they go to theater, they're wounded, evacuated for non-wounds, but illnesses or injuries, et cetera. Knowing their amount of service and under what capacity they served is terribly important to ensure that we don't have people who fall through the crack and are actually entitled to benefits that the bureaucracy says they aren't. So I'd urge your support for those measures so that we can ensure that what you provide us we're able to provide in a timely, accurate way. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today.
Thank you. Lieutenant General Bradley.
Sir, I'm John Bradley, Chief of Air Force Reserve. Thank you for holding this hearing on this very important issue. Thank you for your leadership and the other members who are interested in helping the members of our armed forces. This GI Bill is a very important tool for us in the reserve components, I believe, for recruiting and retention. It does help us in recruiting, and it certainly helps us in retention. It has, over time, I think, degraded somewhat based on the amount that a reservist or guardsman may receive relative to what an active service member receives. Because of some things. So the dialogue here on that issue would be important. And so it's not quite the benefit that it used to be. There also have been proposals that might make it last a shorter period of time than what we've had in the past. I think what would be helpful, and Secretary Hall has recommended this, to use it as a real retention tool is let this last longer than 14 years. Take it to a 20 or 25-year point so that I continue to encourage people to stay with us. Now, I'm fortunate today in that the Air Force Reserve retention is at an almost all-time high. I attribute that to our airmen's feeling that they are part of something very important and doing some important work for our country. So they feel good about their service. But that may not last forever. And we need these benefits to be reviewed periodically to make adjustments so that we continue to encourage people to stay with us, because we want them to stay to 20 and 25 and 30 years as long as they're productive members of our service. So I look forward to this dialogue. I think also, as I indicated at the beginning, that the amount of benefit we have relative to the tuition cost today, perhaps it has not stayed pace with tuition increases. So a review of that, I think, would be helpful as well. But thank you for the leadership on this important issue, and I look forward to your questions.
Thank you. Lieutenant General Bergman, you're now recognized.
Good morning, sir. I'm Jack Bergman, Marine Corps Reserve. Thanks for the opportunity to be here today. Education is so important at all levels, whether it be in military or civilian, that we have to take every opportunity to give the best we can. We see in the QDR that we're in the long war. Therefore, the word long, as in long, longer careers, longer production, longer education, I think is appropriate. By and large, young men and women who join the Marine Corps do not initially join for educational benefits. They join to be Marines. However, long-term retention of good Marines comes from providing worthwhile, broad-based educational benefits, benefits that are equitable from that individual's perception. An example would be when a Marine separates from active duty after a 20-year career, they have 10 years. To utilize their GI Bill. If the reservist, the clock starts at 14 years, the time they finish and goes for 14 years. So you could get a math equation there that doesn't allow them to really do their career, have their civilian job, and get their education in a timely manner before the education benefits run out. We look forward to being a partner with all of you in a process that creates education opportunities and benefits that are basically equitable and easy to utilize. So thank you very much for allowing me to be part of this solution.
Thank you. Major General Young, you're now recognized.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for giving me the opportunity to come here today to discuss the Montgomery GI Bill. I would like to just briefly summarize some of the key points that's already been testified to. The Montgomery GI Bill Selected Reserve and the Reserve Education Assistance Program are a cornerstone to the National Guard recruitment and retention efforts. We sincerely appreciate Congress's continued support of these vital programs. I would also like to thank the members of the Veterans Advisory Committee on Education and the Partnership for Veterans Education for their continued hard work on these important programs. Their efforts have highlighted two areas where we feel the Montgomery GI Bill program could be enhanced, making it an even stronger tool for building and maintaining the Guard and Reserve forces. The first area, and the one that we feel, the Guard feels, is number one priority, is the return of the Montgomery GI Bill Selected Reserve rate back to the 48% range of entitlement as compared to the active duty rate. As you know, back in 2001, the rate for active duty was about $650 per month for a full-time student, and the selective reserve rate was 263. Over the years, the selected reserve rate has not kept pace with the increases in the active duty rate and is now about 28 or 29% of the rate earned by an active duty member, about $1,034 compared to $297. The difference needs to be addressed, and as a result will be an even greater enhancement to our ability to recruit and retain the force. The second priority for the Guard is the retention aspects of the current program. We feel it is very important that a selected reserve member be required to continue their membership and their service in the Guard or the other reserve components in order to use the Montgomery GI Bill benefits. Under the current programs, if the service member separates from the Guard or Reserve, they lose their entitlement to the Montgomery GI Bill selected reserve. We are in favor of retaining this type of a continued service requirement in order to use the benefits. Keeping the unique aspects of the Montgomery GI Bill as they relate to the reserve components is also important. For instance, the services should maintain the function of determining eligibility for benefits, and we should continue to have the ability to combine those benefits to such programs as tuition assistance and others. The reserve components have a vested interest in ensuring their service members are taken care of and should retain their authorities under the current programs. In summary, from the National Guard's perspective, the bottom line is that we need to increase Montgomery GI Bill selected reserve rate, continue the requirement that a service member stay in the Guard to use their benefits, and allow the reserve components to continue managing the unique aspects of the program. I thank the committee for your continued work on this important program and for your continued support of the National Guard.
Thank you very much. Senator McDonald, you're not recognized.
Mr. Chairman, distinguished members of the committee, good morning and thank you for inviting me here today to talk to you about the Montgomery GI Bill. As the chairman introduced me, I'm Rear Admiral Craig McDonald. I'm the commander of the Navy Reserve Forces Command headquartered in New Orleans, Louisiana. And today I'm here representing 70,000 warrior sailors and Vice Admiral Cotton, Chief of Navy Reserve. He sends his respects and regrets he couldn't be here today. As you know, we are in a long war. Fighting in this war are our best and brightest that the United States has to offer. Our sailors are serving around the world on land, on sea, in the air, in a Navy that is more capable and more technically complex than at any other time in our history. We need a total compensation package that will help us attract and retain these outstanding sailors, and the Montgomery GI Bill is a very vital part of that package. The Montgomery GI Bill provides an important incentive for citizens considering joining the military and those already in our force. Having help going to college or paying for technical school can be a very powerful motivator for new sailors and Navy veterans. The Montgomery GI Bill gives an excellent way to improve their earning potential by joining the military. It's a benefit which also gives our present reserve sailors an outstanding reason to continue their affiliation with the reserve component. Maintaining and improving this program is a worthwhile endeavor for all of us, as it not only helps a sailor personally, it helps him or her professionally. I have reviewed the Partnership for Veterans Education proposed changes and offer these comments. As part of Montgomery GI Bill, the portion offered to our selected reservists has not been keeping up with the growing costs of education. The readjustment mechanism built in the program requires revamping. And with the educational costs rising as steadily as they have over the past two decades, the benefits have been devalued. Although the active component was increased in 2000-2001, the reserve component was not increased at the same time. As the Partnership for Veterans Education suggests, the reserve component could be tied to the active benefit to ensure both benefits are increased proportionally when adjustments are made, either programmatically, through indexing, or legislatively. The Partnership on Veterans Affairs has proposed other major changes in both benefits and administration of the GI Bill. These benefits are an important part of the total compensation package, and any proposed changes should be studied to ensure maximum value for service members and the country. The Navy Reserve shares the committee's concerns and is very interested in maintaining the viability of the Montgomery GI Bill. Therefore, the Navy Reserve is participating in and fully supports the joint DOD and VA working group on the Montgomery GI Bill. We are working together to ensure service members have a viable program that helps them grow and provides an incentive for them to serve in the nation's military services. In summary, I would reiterate that this program is a crucial part of the total compensation package offered to our service members. The Navy Reserve looks forward to fully participating in any discussions on how to improve the Montgomery GI Bill. Thank you, and I'm prepared to answer any questions.
Thank you. Admiral?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and distinguished members of the committee. It's a real pleasure for me to be here this morning to discuss educational benefits for the members of the Selected Reserve. The Coast Guard Reserve pioneered the full integration of our reservists into our active component units in the mid-1990s, and so we are always eager for ways that we can assure greater parity and seamless transitions between our active and reserve components. A total force GI Bill may be the possible avenue to help accomplish this. Educational benefits such as the Montgomery GI Bill and the Montgomery GI Bill for the Selected Reserve are important components in recruiting and retaining members of the Coast Guard's total force. We also believe that our tuition assistance program is an invaluable tool for attracting and retaining 21st century talent. In January, we began aggressively marketing the new Reserve Education Assistance Program and have had great interest in that as well. Our recruiters confirm that educational benefits are among the top reasons that individuals join the Coast Guard and decide to affiliate with the Coast Guard Reserve. The fact that Selected Reserve members are not required to pay into the MGIBSR is cited as a plus, and the non-taxable status of the payments and the ability to combine the MGIBSR with tuition assistance are also frequently noted positive features. On the downside, the MGIBSR cannot be used to repay student loans, and this is a limitation that may discourage promising applicants who already have completed some college. Added flexibility in this area is desirable. Our funded selective reserve strength is 8,100. Strong educational benefits help explain why our retention remains at pre-9/11 high levels. Currently, it's about 87.4%, and that's despite very heavy utilization of our reservists in our homeland security missions. The Master Chief Petty Officer of the Coast Guard Reserve Force frequently visits our units, and he is convinced that educational assistance is the key factor in the decision of our first-term members to stay on with the Coast Guard Reserve. We look forward to the results of the Joint DOD and Department of Veteran Affairs Working Group. There is merit to a total force education benefit that combines the best aspects of the existing programs as well as new aspects that will better serve our military men and women. Our paramount concern is that there be no reduction in the quality of service that our members receive, particularly related to the ease of access and timely receipt of benefits. And we would want to ensure that the data systems are in place at the VA to accommodate any new program. To conclude, the Coast Guard Reserve values its longstanding partnership with the Department of Defense Components, support through the Department of Veterans Affairs, and we are eager to maintain parity of benefits for our men and women who serve so well. I am happy to answer your questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I've been placed on notice that we may have some votes that may occur at 11:15 to 11:30. It'll be 15 followed by two fives. So I apologize to the panel. Life on the Hill continues. By way of an opening comment, Secretary Hall, I'd like for you to know that when we had 19 of the veteran service organizations and military service organizations come testify on their views and estimates on the budget and some of their resolutions, I took an opportunity to share with them a concern. And the concern is that you have individuals of whom have been ordered to active duty out of the IRR and have not showed up for duty. And as I understand, the DOD does not want to charge these individuals with AWOL, and that you're seeking to administratively process them. You are in the Veterans Affairs Committee, so we take care of the benefits of the men and women who serve the military once they become veteran status. And there is a concern here. The concern is that if you permit these individuals just to be administratively processed and they receive a general discharge, they may be eligible for their benefits along their veterans' benefits just as if they had gone to war. And that concerns some of us on this committee. So if these individuals who were ordered to appear and did not appear, and you elect not to charge them with AWOL, be arrested and charged with AWOL, and face court-martial, then if you're going to administratively discharge these individuals, they need to be processed in other than honorable conditions. If you process these individuals and they can receive a general discharge in other than honorable conditions, then they will not be entitled to their veterans' benefits. And that's an important distinction. So, Mr. Secretary, if you want to change, we just want you to make sure that these individuals are processed in a manner whereby they can be properly adjudicated. And I'll be very cautious about command influences and things like that, and that's why I shared the committee's concern with the 19 veteran service organizations and military service organizations, that you just need to make sure that the commanders in the field have knowledge of the tools on how to respond to each of their cases. Would you not agree, Mr. Secretary?
Yes, sir, and the services who have those members are proceeding with handling them, and I will ensure that your words and concerns are relayed to those services that are presently considering those members. And I might say that the people in the field that I visit with, IRR members who have reported, are also concerned that they reported and the others did not. And so I will make sure that those concerns are expressed to the individuals, to the people handling the cases now.
Would the gentleman, Chairman Deal, for a minute,
yes.
Directly on that point. The chairman focused on the word general discharge. Now, we know the general discharge is not always, at least the way it used to be, is not always a less than honorable kind of a thing. I suppose someone whose expiration term of service has not been reached, and for the convenience of the government, for some reason or another, the discharge before time, or there are other reasons, I suppose, why people are discharged on a general discharge. And I guess my question is, these people apparently fall under the general discharge, which is unfortunate. I think probably it should not be. Am I right to be concerned about whether we should be referring to general discharge here, as against specifically the type of military that the military person that the chairman is concerned about?
Well, I wouldn't characterize right now the nature of their discharge because it's an ongoing process. The services are looking at them, and so it would be inappropriate to say that they're going to receive this type of discharge, whatever. They're considering that right now, and I will relay your concerns. So no decision has been made on the nature, the type of discharge.
Am I correct, though, the general discharge is not necessarily under other than dishonorable conditions?
You are. And
I am. All right. So taking these people and putting them into that particular package would be, I think, a real terrible mistake.
It requires an administrative process to do that, a hearing.
Yes.
They have their rights. If they had completed their military service and they finished their time in the IRR, no, they receive their honorably handled. But if they've been ordered to active duty, and matter of fact, there's great latitude in the regulations there might be some circumstance whereby you're going to permit their absence. But if this is an individual of whom has just said, no, I'm not showing up.
Yeah, that's.
Then they need to make sure they have the proper tools.
But I would be concerned if that individual, I mean, if you look askance at that individual and want to get rid of him, I would be concerned that that individual would have a general discharge, is what I'm saying.
Yes, sir.
Right.
It should be under
right.
Other than
so
honorable conditions.
So if this is an individual who did not show up to stand side by side his comrades, he should not be entitled to the same benefits as those people who went.
Yeah.
You would agree with that, right?
I would agree with that. Sure.
All right. Now, the other point I wanted to make, you know, as the Reserve Commission is out there, and they are also taking into this issue on the IRR, on how we're going to properly manage the IRR. And we want to make sure that we also match our benefits. So, you know, General Helmley, the IRR, you used to manage the IRR, and they've taken that responsibility from you. Is that correct, or am I?
Mr. Chairman, as we integrated our personnel commands or centers in the U.S. Army Reserve and the regular Army into an Army Human Resources Command, the decision was made that daily management would fall to the commander of Human Resources Command. I do not consider that I then lost responsibility. I believe if you look at the definition of reserve of the Army in law, it is inclusive of the IRR, and therefore I'm not worried too much about who manages the records on a daily basis as much as an acceptance of my obligation to advise the Chief of Staff Army and the Army leadership about use, et cetera, of the IRR.
Well, here's my point. I want to be able to match the benefit with the continued service. And maybe part of our other concern is when they finish a four-year commitment, maybe they shouldn't get their honorable discharge at that moment in time. Maybe you give it a different name, a title. But they don't receive their, quote, discharge until they fulfilled their commitment of their contract, which includes that inactive duty time. And then that you manage them properly. You know where they are. You know what their physical shape and condition is. And they're also drawing their benefits. So whether we look at the GI Bill benefits, and if they're continuing to draw those benefits, but yet when they've been ordered back to active duty, or for some whatever reason we don't know where they are, I mean, that's telling me that we got some problems with this inactive duty status within the IRR.
Mr. Chairman, I concur with you. Historically, we have not done a credible job of disciplining the records keeping. Large numbers of the IRR, frankly, as they were moved from some other status, be it selected reserve or the regular Army, their records should never have been coded that they were in the IRR. We have people in there who never completed basic training, but their records were shipped from the training center, coded IRR. We have people who never shipped to basic training. Their records were coded IRR. It has been very undisciplined under the leadership of our Manpower and Reserve Affairs Director. We've undertaken efforts to clean up the record keeping, the coding, et cetera. But it will take time to clean that record keeping mess up. I concur with your observations regarding benefits that we accord members. We have the situation where we stop loss members of the selected reserve. Others have moved to the IRR with no action and without a request and without a valid reason to go there. And I concur with you that if they are then ordered to active duty under competent mobilization authority, we should ensure that the laws and the regulations are applied in an even manner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I want to thank you for holding this hearing. There has been quite a bit of interest in this topic through the years and on the Armed Services Committee. Perhaps it's because you left the Armed Services Committee, but I've been unsuccessful in getting this kind of a hearing on that side. And as you know, we've got this issue about the benefit is covered by both committees. But I know this is just the first step in this process. I'm going to try to make Congressman Bozeman's hearing in Northwest Arkansas next week, which I think we have so many veterans, and a lot of them, as you all know, have been called up in the Guard and Reserves and the Air Force Reserve, Army Reserve, Marine Corps Reserve. So I think we'll get a good sampling of people. But I think it's important that we're looking at this topic, and I know that you intend this to be just the opening inning of this game. I appreciate you doing it. I wanted to go through here, if I could, and just very quickly on Mr. Carr, in your written statement, you state, quote, the MGIB benefit should be sufficient to offset the commitment and sacrifices associated with military service. The current program continues to serve the active components of the military well. It is our belief that there are no significant shortcomings to the program from our perspective, end of quote. And then Mr. Hall, in your written statement, you say, quote, I'm seeing a pattern here. That's my quote, not yours. Quote, we have not identified any significant shortcomings in the structure and utility of the MGIB-SR, end of quote. And then you go on down below on page 3 to say, we have not identified any further changes we need to make to this program at this time, end of quote. But that is, in my view, your all's both statements that there are no significant shortcomings is in contrast with what we have heard from this panel. If I might quickly, Mr. Chairman, run through these. General Helmley, in his written statement, states, quote, the cost of college education has risen dramatically over the past 10 years, and there now is a significant disparity in the dollar amount for the active components, Montgomery GI Bill, Chapter 30, and the MGI Bill, MGIB for the selected reserve, Chapter 1606 and 1607, end of quote, a significant disparity. On page 3, General Helmley's statement says, it hasn't, referring to the selected reserve, MGIB, it hasn't kept up with increasing tuition costs and is not commensurate with the expanded role of the Army Reserve. He goes on to say, quote, an increase in the monetary benefit is needed in the MGIB SR, end of quote. In General Bergman's written statement, he says the value of the reserve component has decreased since its initial implementation, end of quote. In General Bradley's written statement, he states that, quote, the Montgomery GI Bill originally established reserve education benefits at 48% of the regular component benefit. Regular component benefits have increased over time with the result that the reserve benefit has fallen to approximately 27%. So it decreased from 48% to 27%. End of quote. To me, by the way, Mr. Chairman, that is a key and part of that got a lot of members' attention, is the drop in this benefit compared to the active has occurred. And then also in General Bradley's written statement, he says, quote, the time has come to look at how the Montgomery GI Bill can be used as a total force incentive, end of quote. General Young, in your statement, your oral statement this afternoon, you mentioned, or this morning, the differences that we need to deal with those differences. And then Admiral McDonald, you, in your oral statement today, specifically, I believe your words, that educational costs have been devalued because of the inflation rate. Well, in fairness to you gentlemen up here, you know, this is a brief hearing and this is just scratching the surface, but those members of this committee are concerned about this issue, as a lot of members are who are not a member of this committee. This is what we have heard from people back home, and some of us are veterans. And I know the value, the educational value, has been diminished, dramatically so since post-World War II. So I think there are, quote, significant shortcomings in the current benefit, and I believe the chairman's calling of this hearing today is just the initial part of this, is an acknowledgement of that and an acknowledgement that we want to work on this. We also recognize that we have issues of money, that we have issues of complexity, we have issues of fairness, we have our own internal issues between our Title 10, our the way the legislation is set up. But I am interested in working on this with the chairman and Mr. Bozeman and Ms. Herseth and others, and I look forward to working with all of you, because I do believe there are significant shortcomings to the current benefit. Appreciate you all being here. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'd welcome any comment on Dr. Schneider's opening. Any of you had any comments on his comments? Yes, Mr. Carr?
I think the with regard to the arguments had to do with equity, which is important in many of the military compensation programs we undertake. Equity, for the sake of equity, can be a compelling and prevailing pervasive argument. In the case of the Montgomery GI Bill, in the case of the active, that it serves well, given that 97% enroll, that 70% use, that it covers 77% of the tuition cost, better than at the outset of the program. Those are the reasons for which I said that in the case of the Montgomery GI Bill program for the active, it was okay. But I think that, sir, you do point to the area that's the rub here, and that is we have the reserves increasingly serving on active duty. And what we have to do is to create the balance between the benefit and the sacrifice so that it squares in our judgment. And the fact that they have grown apart because different decisions were made in the public sector is notable, but the degree to which they should converge is the difficult part. And I think therein, two principles guide us. One, that service in the selected reserve is more valuable than ready, and service on active duty is especially valuable, and you can begin to converge toward the active benefit when those types of conditions are met. So those guide us in terms of how to close the gaps that you so correctly pointed out.
Since you asked Dr. Snyder for comment, I would say your question is a good one. I would say that I'm not looking for parity or equity with the active force, but frankly, since this began, my reservists are working almost twice as much as they worked before the benefit began, and their benefit is essentially half of what it was when it began. My airmen and many of the other reservists and guardsmen who are represented here by their component chiefs, I think would tell you as well that our folks are doing a lot. I've been to a lot of sessions with where we have had events for wounded soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marine, and Coast Guardsmen, and a huge percentage, a large percentage of the folks who are injured in our current efforts are members of the reserve components. So I think their sacrifices are significant, and they deserve at least something rather than a shrinking benefit, at least maintaining where they were, because we are an operational reserve today. We are being used in ways in which some people never envision doing it. I personally think it's a good thing to be used as an operational reserve, but I think my airmen deserve a benefit that matches the level of effort that they are putting into our war.
Thank you. I might. Sir, I wanted to have one comment on that. I don't think there's probably any disagreement that we need to address a couple of issues. One is the atrophying of the benefit down to 28%, and also the length of time in which selected reservists could use the bill. I think we need to move towards incentivizing people to stay longer rather than leave earlier. So perhaps the length of time at 14 years is not right. I think the issue at hand is the manner in which we do that. We have the Joint Committee, which is meeting now, should report out by June. They might well agree, the Joint DOD and VA Committee, of raising the rates. They might well agree of lengthening the time. My statement indicated that it was not in the 07 bill from the department in any of those proposals, which of course is part of clearing the OMB process, et cetera. Should they come to the conclusions in the Joint Committee that those rates and others need to be addressed, I'm sure the department would send those forward.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I concur with Dr. Carr's comment that we've had proposals that would make rates of entitlement and benefits for reserve component members roughly approximate those of regular armed force members. And then we have to ask ourselves about the negative effect on our regular forces. The issue is, first of all, to acknowledge that the rate has not been modernized since approximately 01. We faced that in a different thing called the first-term reenlistment rate, where it wasn't so much trying to raise that to the active component rate as the fact that when we raised the active component rate, we neglected to address the reserve component rate. And it put both of the Guard and Reserve forces roughly 2 years behind playing catch-up on retention. We don't need to do that on a very important tool for recruiting and retention, our educational benefits, which comprise more than simply the Montgomery GI Bill. The last remark I'd make is that I agree completely with Secretary Hall. Our focus needs to be on retention. not solely the rate at which we're mobilizing. We will not be mobilizing at this rate forever, but we will be dependent on a stronger, more robust Guard and Reserve force roughly forever, in my own judgment. The world has changed in major ways, and we must adjust how we plan to man our all-volunteer recruited forces differently for this century than we did last century. That's why I appreciate the strategic view of this hearing. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Bill Rockus?
Well, Mr. Chairman, we're running out of time, and I can't run as fast as I used to get over there in time to cast that vote.
How much time do we have?
But 9 minutes.
We need...
I'll just make a statement, because otherwise you're not going to be able to ask your questions. Veep, I'm just concerned about the issue of this hearing as expressed by Dr. Snyder and by the chairman. But I'd sort of go even past that. And I'm really concerned about Veep. I'm concerned about the unfairness to that member of the military who had to make that decision, you know, at one particular time. And did not do so for whatever reason. And I'm very grateful to the GI Bill. $110 a month is what it was, the Korean War GI Bill. Well, not much, but I tell you, it was just enough there to get me started, and I had to work my way through the rest of the time, too. But I made that decision after I got out of the service. I mean, I had intended to go to college. I told all the recruiters who tried to keep me in that I was going to go on to school. But I made the decision afterwards, and it has, you know, for me to have made that decision during basic training, which was maybe some of the worst 8 weeks of my life, would have been pretty damn unfair. So I wanted to get your comments on that, but really we don't have the time, and I'm not going to ask for it now, but I'm here to just put you all on notice, as the chairman did regarding his subject, put you on notice that I feel very strongly about maybe reopening that, as expensive as it is. And hopefully you all will cooperate in that regard. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. The committee is going to stand in recess. We need to come back. I apologize to all of you, but we have a lot we have to get on the record, and we need to have a good dialogue here. So the committee will stand in recess for approximately 30 minutes.
That's a good idea.
Not to mention. Thank you.
Michael, I'm going to go right to you.
I won't take off.
Okay. All right.
The committee will come back to order. I now recognize Mr. Bilirakis.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wasn't sure that we would be coming back. And I apologize for coming in late. I had a, as we sometimes do here, had a hearing in health care on transparency of health costs in one of the other committees. I'm just going to stay on VEEP, Mr. Chairman, because the GI Bill, over the decades, over the couple of centuries, I suppose, have passed legislation up here. Sometimes we don't understand the unintended consequences of our acts, and some of it can turn out to be not as good as we hoped it would be. But I think we'd all agree GI Bill has just been a wonderful thing and a great thing for America, for our republic. It's served us well. So to preclude a fair opportunity to all of the men and women who have served in the service, I think is wrong on our part, and that's why I'm so concerned about VEEP. And I would just merely, in whatever time I might have left, ask to see if you have any comments there. I realize we're talking about transferring VEEP over to Montgomery Bill under circumstances other than those where under which they were done previously, but with more flexibility, is going to be a costly thing. And I know these things come out of the appropriate budgets and that sort of thing. But it seems like if we all have flexibility in our minds, possibly those people who get back enrolled, if you will, their contribution is increased or something of that nature. But anyhow, any comments, gentlemen, just very briefly on that? You know, if we're concerned about MGIB and we're concerned about GI Bill, et cetera, in general, we've got to be concerned, too, about some people who didn't have really a fair opportunity, at least in my mind,
Congressman,
to enroll.
I concur with reopening the window on VEEP. It seems to me that a young 18 to 22-year-old, which is the age category we really aim for in recruitment, coming into basic training is exposed to a brave new world. Tomorrow for that age the future for that age category is tomorrow, not 5-10 years from now. Most are predisposed on disposable income that I can buy a motorcycle with as opposed to go to school. So I concur with that. I think that later on when the member has settled into the military,
yes,
and realizes that it's not the big bad thing that they thought, that we're not going to just throw them out to the wolves, and has gotten over the emotionalism associated with this great new adventure in life, they will think more clearly.
Yes, sir.
And that's why I concur with them.
Good. Hey, yes, sir.
Yes, sir. I happen to agree with you. My aide sitting back here was caught up in that. He was a young ensign coming in the program and decided not to take it. And now he's kind of kicking himself that if we could reopen that, he would take it at that real fast. And that has a tool that we can use as our entire package for our people across the service.
Sure. And now he's still in the service on active duty. So. But should we reopen it also to those who have gotten out of the service? Maybe there should be a certain period of time within which after discharge.
Yes, sir. But my thought process on that would be that if we do that, then we're looking this as a tool to retain them in our.
Yes, I appreciate that.
Come back to our drilling population, if that may be the case, and then serve that time. That would be ideal if that's what they could do. Yes, sir.
Well, of course, we've already talked about, at least I mentioned it, I'm sure you all have too, others have, the greatness of the GI Bill. And the GI Bill was certainly not something that was used basically for retention purposes, but it's been great for America in general. So if we would preclude those who have been discharged from having that opportunity, I think that would be a mistake too. Yes, sir, Mr. Secretary.
Yes, sir, thank you. The VEEP is a program compared to the MGIB that was of considerably lesser value.
Yeah.
And the way it operated was that the member could invest in an account and get some extra education benefit in lieu of that. Recognizing that, the committee had two open seasons.
Yes.
For the those Veepsters. One was for those who had money in their account at the time, and then again another open season for those who ever had money in their account. And so the only ones excluded from open seasons to this point have been those who manifest no behavior toward an interest in the education
program. At the outset of their basic training.
And so I mentioned that's the population we're discussing here. Yeah. There's been considerable work by the committee already toward VEEP. With regard to the sentiment toward VEEP and the Defense Department, there's great sensitivity toward it because they're serving in today's military. But the bill is one that falls to the Veterans Administration. And so in that case, the question might be answered differently if it were an item that were to be funded from the defense budget than if it were to be funded by Veterans Affairs. And I just report that observation of perhaps the obvious.
Well, I get the feeling, though, that you're all thinking sort of positive in that regard. And I realize that we have our barriers or the type of money and the language and that sort of thing. And any other, I don't mean to cut anyone off, but I guess, okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I yield back.
This, for yield to Mr. Michaud, this is going to be one of our challenges, Dr. Snyder, between your jurisdiction on armed services and ours. And we need to drill this down a little bit further in a moment about this as a retention or recruiting tool and how it is rated among other tools that you may have. If we take jurisdiction, if the VA takes total jurisdiction over this, DOD transfers all of this to the VA, we then are removing really some discretionary authorities over civilian leadership, tools that these uniformed leaders. Get to use. You know what I'm trying to say? I mean, that's going to be our challenge. It's easy to say, okay, let's just transfer all this over to us, and we'll administer the VA this for you. But if your testimony has been pretty clear that this is a retention tool for you, and when I hear certain benefits are used as tools from you, you need to have some discretion and latitude. That's my sensing on it. But let me yield now to Mr. Michaud.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for having this hearing. And actually, my question relates to the retention issue. Assistant Secretary Hall, in your written testimony, you stated that, and I quote, the fact that a member must continue to serve in the reserves to maintain eligibility has greatly assisted the reserve components as a whole in maintaining consistently high retention rate over the years. In the quote, I'm curious to as what you base your conclusion on, as I understand it, with respect to the retention issue, education benefits are quite low in the priority list for members when determining whether to continue or separate from the reserves. Maybe that's because the benefits aren't there. When I looked at Mr. Bradley's testimony in there, he said that they have gathered information to help us better gauge the importance our members place on their education benefits. And according to a 2004 status, only 14% of the respondents stated education benefits affect their continuation decision. So I'm just wondering, Assistant Secretary, what do you base that quote on?
As you probably know, I spent 34 years on active duty, and during those 34 years of active duty, I learned how important it was to not sit behind a desk and presume what people thought. So during my 3.5 years, I've talked to 200,000 people, 200,000 from all services in the field, and here's what they tell me. They consistently list the Montgomery GI Bill as one of their top five programs that they value. Now, not all of them say they use it.
And that's very important. Even if you don't use it, you feel that the government is giving you something which you can use, and it's positive, and they know that as long as they remain a selected reservist drilling, they can use it. They also consistently say, however, the rates have atrophied, and we need to do something about it. And they also indicate that perhaps ending the eligibility at 14 years, maybe we ought to extend that up through 20, 25, or some other period of time. So they talk about having it a longer period of time they can use and addressing the rates. But they all tell me that it's a very important benefit. Even if they don't use it, they know that it's there if they want to. Now, my colleagues who command all of those might have a different perspective. But that's how I gained that, from going and talking to them, holding a town hall and saying, what are your four or five benefits which are important to you? And Montgomery GI Bill always stands up as high as something that they think we're giving them the opportunity to use, whether they use it or not.
And I guess the next question would be Mr. Bradley, because actually you mentioned you heard the top five, and looking at your written testimony, you said approximately half rated education benefits number nine out of 17 as a factor. And
yes, sir. Our utilization rate is lower than perhaps we'd like. I think that's a reflection of a couple of things. And it also, I think, may affect where they place it in their survey of what's important to them as far as that list of benefits that they think are rank ordered or in importance. I think the amount of work we're doing, the operations tempo that our folks are under over the last several years is so high, many people are not able to continue education because they're working hard for us, many times deployed. So it's just not possible to do as much because we're making them do more reserve work. We're asking them to do more, and they're volunteering to do it. So I think that's why the utilization is not as high as you would expect. I think the fact that the amount of the benefit has, so to speak, degraded over the years may also be a reflection. You know, it's about enough to buy books for a couple of courses, is what they tell me, which everything helps, but maybe it could be better. So I think that's really the answer to that, and also the fact that the benefit terminates after the 14th year. Many times folks have come to us from the active service, 6-8 years of service, and then they come to us. So there are not that many years for them to use it, because at 14 years after they sign up, they're done. I think, like Secretary Hall's proposal, to make this a 20 or 25 year, I'd go for a 25. I think it could be a retention tool. It's not going to be what keeps everybody in, but it'll keep some in, I think. So I think it'd be a positive thing for our retention if we increase the number of years of which an individual would be eligible for this benefit.
Thank you. Like the other branches, also to comment, do you do a similar survey? And if so, how does education fall in that survey? And do you think if it rates low, is it because the benefits are not, in your opinion, where they should be?
I'd be happy to talk about the Coast Guard for you, sir. We have a career intention survey, which is administered not just as an exit survey, but when you change status. So if someone would go from enlisted to officer through a commissioning program, or if they would go into a new enlistment contract, we ask them to complete that survey. There are a few things that are cited in a higher priority than education. They include pay, job security, healthcare, medical, dental specifically, but then after those, you also consistently find education, educational opportunity, as well as education assistance listed as reasons that people want to be within the military. So we find that it is very much a factor that influences retention decisions as well as enlistment decisions, sir.
I don't have the numbers right at my fingertips, sir, but when the our Marines go through their transition TAMP class, when they transition from active duty, they do fill out surveys. The the incidents, the level of education, taking advantage of that right after completion of their active duty is, I would suggest, in the Marine Corps, probably lower than our sister services for varying reasons. Some of our young Marines just choose to chill out for a while after the intensity of the activity. But those Marines who join the Marine Corps Reserve and continue to serve, when they've developed a parallel civilian career, they become more aware that to be a success in a civilian occupation, they need to continue to educate themselves in that chosen field. And then it seems like it falls over, that all of a sudden the light goes on, and that education, whether it be on the military side or how they use these benefits to grow themselves, if you will, in either one or both realms, clicks in.
Congressman, I think that all of us would tell you that we do our own surveys in addition to using those administered by the Department of Defense. Educational benefits, I believe, are perceived by the soldier as a normal benefit during abnormal times. While in the historical sense, it's not abnormal at all to mobilize reserve component members during a time of conflict. The suddenness of this conflict and the fact that it's extending creates the abnormality. And so if you look at Army Reserve specific surveys, most soldiers say that items such as predictability and length of mobilization, as well as period between mobilizations, are their most pressing concerns. If you look back prior to 9/11 at what prompted more people to stay in or to enlist, educational benefits inclusive of others besides Montgomery GI Bill, notably tuition assistance, were consistently ranked number one or two with regard to what motivated them to enlist and or to stay.
And when we take a percentage, the one key question would be, if we decompose that and say who is the most predisposed toward this benefit, the answer is enlisted and specifically junior enlisted. Given that the topic is retention, it is a fact from defense surveys that cut across the components that 25% of the E1 to 4 in the reserves believe that education benefits figure prominently in their decision, way ahead of health care, way ahead of retirement, in fact, almost just a little bit below pay and benefits. So when we decompose who is it that we get a bang from the buck from, it's the crowd we want to influence favorably to retain. We have other incentives. If you go to the senior crowd, they're going to be more disposed toward the retirement system and its value. But if you're trying to work the junior enlisted, and that's the base of the pyramid, then MGIB is a strong pusher.
Mr. Show, you yield on that point for a second. Who are you citing? Who would you cite as an authority for your testimony?
For the figures I just gave?
Yes.
Defense Manpower Data Center, in surveys that it gives annually to the reserves and to the active. And I've got a summary of it I could provide to staff.
I would appreciate that. Yes, I'd appreciate if you could get us that survey. I think it'd be helpful to us.
Absolutely.
Because we were able to discern that that from this very same survey, 14% stated that education benefits affected their continuation decision. And half of those surveys ranked education ninth out of the 17th benefits. So that doesn't link very well. So General Bradley, that was from
your testimony. I think that was
testimony.
A survey that the Air Force Reserve did, not a DOD-wide survey.
Well, then, please reconcile the difference between Mr. Carr, your testimony that you just gave to Mr. Michaud based on data from your manpower and Lieutenant General Bradley's testimony, relying upon, we got two surveys here that are in conflict.
I remember I cited a subset of the population, that being the junior enlisted, and that their behavior was particularly rich. The opposite is true if you go to the more senior ranks, depressing how robust that conclusion is. So that would influence it. But the Defense Manpower Data Center surveys are consistent over time. We have a longitudinal history of them. And again, we'll be delighted to provide them if that would be constructive.
I welcome your comments, Senator Bradley. Please.
Sir,
will you concur with this?
Sir, I am certain that's right. I would imagine, I would think that junior folks, young folks who join would cite education as being much more important, education benefits being much more important to them when they make a decision to join or stay than someone who's much older. So my survey would cover the entire force. I did not break it down into that young junior enlisted category about which he spoke.
All right, I'll go back, Mr. Michaud. Well, then, let me take this one step further. I'm trying to reconcile this survey with also your testimony about the needs to have, let's take advantage of the inequities, let's address the rate problems, and then you come with a survey of your 2004 Status of Forces Survey of Reserve Component Members. Only 14% of respondents stated educated benefits affected their continuation decision. Can you please comment on this?
Yes, sir. What I think may play into that survey is the fact that the educational benefits are not worth what they were several years ago. I think it reflects also the operations tempo of our forces. They are so much busier and are deployed in their busyness now in what they do. They're deployed, and so it is not easy or convenient to do night schools or whatever they do to complete these additional educational programs. That makes it a lot more difficult. I think that is a reason why it doesn't rank as high. I think in other times when we're not as busy, it probably would seem like it's a better benefit to them. That is my conjecture. So I think it is only one tool that we could use for retention. I think the fact that people like what they do and they think it's important is a reason why they stay with us. But education helps a certain population of it. And I just think that any help we get to keep to retain people would be a good thing, but it is not the be-all and end-all for retention, I don't think.
Mr. Chairman, I might be able to help in clarifying this. It is from the Status of Forces survey. 14%, which you cite, and 25%, which I cite for junior enlisted, are both part of that survey. So the correct answer for the respondents in total is about 14%. I cited E1 to 4. But if we looked at E5 through 9, it's only 9%. It becomes less important. Again, talking about the education benefit. And officers are all 5% or below. So as a group, they would respond 14% as it being important. But disproportionately, the junior enlisted E1 to 4 felt that it was important to them. Not remarkable, because they see that. And they don't count much on health care because they consider themselves invincible. And they don't look at retirement because that's well out in the future. Therefore, you get a skewed reaction to the education appeal if you're talking to the very youngest members.
When we say GI Bill, a lot of people immediately will think, all right, the World War II, all right, soldiers coming home. Well, we had a draft. So the draft went across the population and brought many people in to serve their country, and then we provided that education for them, and we as a society benefited tremendously from that. Then we transitioned to the all-volunteer force, and under the leadership of Sonny Montgomery, worked 7 years to produce the Montgomery GI Bill, as a, quote, tool to the services on recruiting and retention of the all-volunteer force. We find ourselves, though, very challenged. You recruit individuals then to come join the all-volunteer force to obtain your education. And yet then we also have the reserve components and the National Guard, individuals of whom are already, not all of them, but you are also using us as a tool to join the Guard, join the reserve. You can obtain your education benefit on a part-time basis and serve your country. But we also have equally a large portion that are already in their job that they want to, they're comfortable with their career path. And then they find themselves at war, and then we want to immediately judge them and say, well, but you're eligible for a benefit, and you're not utilizing the benefit, and you can't force that horse to drink. You see what I'm trying to say? So earlier, I mean, General Bradley, I think you're the one that said, you know, inequity for inequity's sake.
But, sir, you know, one thing I would add is the benefit has timed out for many of the people who are answering this survey. If they are beyond 14 years of service, the benefit doesn't matter to them probably because they're not eligible for it any longer. So the day you sign up, a 14-year clock starts, and it runs out at 14 years, and so if you're serving at 15, 16, 20, 25 years, you're not eligible for this benefit anymore. So to those respondents to a survey, the benefit is irrelevant. So I think it might be more relevant, be used more, and be a little retention tool, I think, if we could make it to a 20 or 25-year benefit instead of 14.
Let me go to the rate issue for a second. I noted that under the original 9-to-1 GI Bill benefit to the contribution level, I looked at the numbers. So here, under the original Montgomery GI Bill, we have the $1,200 contribution. The pay of an E-1 at the time was $573.60. So on a pre-tax contribution, so when back in 1985, when Sonny Montgomery got everyone to go along with this, that was 17%. That contribution was 17% of $573. That was a $103 pre-tax contribution. I mean, think about that. That's a lot out of the $573. The payout at the time was $10,800. Okay. The payout today is around $37,200. Yet the contribution has also maintained itself at $1,200. So the contribution is not—it's not even the 9-to-1 ratio anymore. So if today's based on today's E-1 salary of $1,273, if you want to maintain the 9-to-1 ratio on the payout, the contribution from the soldier should increase to $216 a month pre-tax. So the contribution based off today's payout should be $4,136. So this whole issue about having skin in the game, you know, about what's your personal investment to your own education given the payout, the contribution hasn't even maintained relative to the payout as designed by Sonny Montgomery and the committee at the time. I just want to make sure all of you knew and understood that. Now, as we then go to the reserve components, this whole issue about equity for equity's sake, the reservists, they're not making a contribution. So, if we want to bring this back into balance, we're talking about increasing the contribution with regard to soldiers, and whether or not reserve components should also be making a contribution into the GI Bill benefit. I'm just throwing this out to you. You can't just say, well, we're going to do it for equity, but, gee, I want some, but then I don't have skin in the game either. So I want to have a conversation with all of you about this. So if we're going to say, okay, now we make this original amendment to say, okay, we're going to go to the 1606 benefit. So if we go into the reserve components, it was about $297 a month, and at that time it was about 48% to 49% of the active duty rate. And according to your testimony, Secretary Hall, you're saying that that has now shrunk to about 28%. Now, that's DOD's responsibility, Secretary Hall. I view that as your responsibility at DOD. This one is, if your senior leaders are saying this is an important tool to us and it's not being kept or maintained, you got to tell us this. Because obviously this thing, I believe it needs to be increased. We're going to have to bring that, the 1606 benefit up. And it's not linked to anything right now. When we did the 1607, it was linked. And it was able to maintain itself to the active. But if we're going to continue to do these increases, should there be a level of contribution from the reserve components? So let me turn that over to you. This is a policy question, and I need your best counsel. They're not going to be volunteers. I'm going to go right down the line. All right? Let me start with the Coast Guard.
Sir, I would say that you have to look at the totality of tools that you have to use to influence our service members. And so the fact that there is no pay-in by the reservist is an inducement. And if we were to require a pay-in, that may have then diminished attractiveness to that reservist, which would then cause us to have to use another tool, potentially, to attract them, recruit them, retain them in the services.
Sir, I recommend you just stay the way it is. I have no data to show that if we make them have a pay-in, whether it's going to make a difference or not. But from what I see from my Navy reservists, the program as is benefits them across the board if they don't have to pay in. I would like to see it stay that way.
General Young?
Sir, I have to agree. I'm not in favor of a contribution on behalf of the service member to continue to receive CELRES or Selective Reserve Benefit.
So I want equity with the active components, but I don't want to pay for it. Is that what I'm hearing? I mean, come on.
That's on day one.
No, I'm serious. I'm going to pick on all three of you for a second. You'll hold fast. I know you really want to jump in this fight. That's really not what you're telling me, is it?
Well, equity would be then, would we give them the entire 100% return without a pay-in? We are, obviously, the Navy Reserve is not exactly the active Navy. So there are differences. So I think this is an equitable tool by no pay-in, but you're not receiving the 100% benefit.
All right. General Bergman?
Sir, I would suggest to you that equity in this instance refers to a perception in the mind of the individual for what they're receiving, for what they're giving, if you will, in their time. And to that reserve Marine, they know, for example, when it comes to a perception of equity, some of their active component counterparts wonder why they get two drills for one day's pay. What's equity? You know, the point is, in the dollar value benefit, I do not see a need to change to put the reserve component equal with the active duty as far as what they receive in that actual dollar output.
Yeah, that'd be a disincentive for the active duty.
All right. Committee's going to stay in recess for about 2 minutes.
I don't know what he's talking about. So
I mean, just drop off and use your
following.
Oh, I know, but there's a whole series of questions.
You can't just get it on the record.
We're still in recess. Mr. Bill Rakus, did you have any further questions?
No, Mr. Chairman,
we'll come back to order.
I don't have any questions. I just want to raise a point here that I've been talking to staff about. I guess I wasn't aware that a reservist can pick up this benefit or it was immediately on day one, whereas someone serving on active duty doesn't get the right to the benefit unless they've served what is either 3 years or 2 years, depending on what the contract is for. You know, active duty, I'm not belittling the role of the reservists. God knows in this day and age, they're thank God for them. But I'm not sure that they should be able to pick up the benefit. Am I correct? The benefits... Does someone have to serve in the reserves for a certain period of time first before they have the right to this education benefit?
I think it is enlist or re-enlist for 6 years, make that obligation, whereas on active duty, someone can correct me, you can start it after 2 years. But within the reserve, if you make an obligation of 6 years or re-enlist for six, you are eligible for it. So just make the commitments you're going to serve for 6 years in the reserve, unless somebody wants to correct that. I think you
now, must they have served that 6 years?
Yes. No, not serve 6 years. Agree to serve 6 years, and you can start picking up the benefit.
Yeah, so okay. So it goes right back to what
6 years, yeah. You can start.
Yeah, you can start on day one then.
Yeah. No, I think it's after amount of training.
Well, all right. So it's after 2 months or whatever it might be.
Well, there's a small period that you have to complete some active duty for training period, yeah. A small time, and then you can start it. So there is a little bit of training piece you have to do successfully. You begin it. It's not very long. I think it's a matter of weeks or months.
Well, I realize you're all representing the Reserve Corps, and they are very, very important to us. But I don't know. I find something wrong with all that.
Could I make a comment? Because it relates,
sir,
to the chairman's question. You know, the words equal and fair, I think we have to think about. Because something is not equal, is it perceived to be fair? And we heard the word perception. And I think to get the idea that in order to be fair, we must have the reserve benefit exactly equal to the active duty is wrong. Because if we have those, why not, if the pay is the same, if all the benefits are the same, you have to characterize the nature of the service. And I think in the minds of a guardsman or reservist, fair rather than equal is what they look at. And I think originally when Sonny Montgomery put this together and the benefits were at 48% of the active duty, based upon the characterization of your service, you weren't full-time, they thought that was a fair thing. Now that it's atrophied, perhaps in their view, it's not the equal. Is it still as fair as it was at that point? So I think they focus more on perhaps having it for a longer length of time, perhaps having it back at what it started at the 48%, and that would be fair. I don't think they would say it has to be exactly equal to active duty and the same things before the situation. So I think we just need to think about the fair and equal between the two and characterize the nature of the service. And they will end up being different benefits, but if they are perceived to be fair, then I think our young men and women will reenlist and will continue to serve. That's my view on the equality versus fairness.
Mr. Chairman, I realize that the focus is on retention, and that's awfully significant. And if we look at it from a retention standpoint, then I stand corrected. But I think we've already, again, I keep repeating this, the value that the GI Bill has been to our way of life. And if we think of that, then I think we ought to also be thinking about beyond just retention, as significant as retention is. It should be a little bit of a reward, I should think, for the person who served a certain period of time.
All right. To focus this then, so we don't get too far out of the box on redesign, the issue is going toward rate and length of time. Is that where we kind of, the length of time for the opportunity to utilize the benefit?
I would commend to you, and I've heard several of my peers also state this, also the use of the benefit, that is to allow, as you noted in your comments, for certain types of training, not just the traditional college degree.
I would also, Mr. Chairman, last year some of the changes you made to use for some of the certification and training courses was received exceptionally well by our members. And I think a further expansion of that into things for long-range truck drivers and other kinds of courses would be welcomed as a positive step. So expanding some of the training, certification, and other kinds of skills would be the third item in addition to the rate and length.
All right. General Helmley, then an issue, or General Bradley, for actually this is for the entire panel, credentialing. Right now, if you've got one of your mechanics working on a particular aircraft and he's been trained to work on that aircraft, and now he wants to leave, but now he can't go down and work on that aircraft because he's not been properly certified according to blah, blah, blah.
Yes, sir. I would be in favor of that. I would agree with what General Helmley just said and Secretary Hall. I think those changes would make it a much more viable, helpful program.
Okay. So focus more predominantly on these three issues, the rate, the opportunity of use, i.e. length of time, and then the credentialing. And you, what word did you use? You used credentialing. You called it?
Certification.
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 Yes, sir. That's what I would agree with.
They certify some body credentials.
All right. I need to do this for the record. I'd like to go down the line. From Lieutenant General Helmley on down. I want you to give me a good 35, 40-second snapshot of one of your reservists, Coast Guardsmen, National Guardsmen, been brought to active duty. Tell me what happens to them. For example, tank platoon commander, round out. I need to get on the record when they serve next to an active duty counterpart, that counterpart gets X, but my person doesn't get what, gets utilized what in comparison? Can you do that for me, General Hemley?
Congressman, I think the biggest complaint, in fact, I know the biggest complaint we have from Army Reserve soldiers is not so much measurement of benefits and entitlements as it is the treatment.
Will you hold just a second?
Yes, sir.
I've got to go down there. Can you finish this question?
This question?
Yes. All right. Mr. Bilirakis is going to take the chair to finish this series of questions, and then I'm going to need to take off.
You said this question.
And any other follow-on you would love to have. We're going to have questions that we'll submit for the record. I want to thank you for coming. This is very important, and I appreciate that. You helped focus us in three very important areas that can be very helpful to you.
He's answering the question was comparing
And that's sort of consistent with my concern too. So please, who had the floor here?
Congressman,
General, go ahead, sir.
Congressman Booyer had asked for each of us to address an issue as regards how our reserve component members may feel relative to an active component member. I had just responded that I personally do not often hear a complaint about equity of benefits, and I agree with Secretary Hall. It's really about benefits and entitlements commensurate with one service, commensurate with inactive service as opposed to daily active duty service. Having said that, the biggest complaint we have about relative to active component is regards to treatment, and I don't mean an intentional Army bad treatment of reserve component members. As much as we mobilize them, we consider them to be unready rather than treating them as a professional soldier, challenging them, providing them kinds of training that challenge them, that energize them looking forward. They'll often point, I don't understand why I had to spend 75, 90 days at a MOB station trying on new kinds of boots, why I couldn't just be issued the boots ahead of time, why if I'd passed the PT test ahead of time, you didn't take it like my active component counterpart. Those kind of things. It's they see it as somewhat dehumanizing. The Army's made strides. It issues our reserve component members the same kinds of equipment, et cetera, but they complain often about the length of time and before I get to theater and start getting on with my business.
Yep. Yeah, and I think we get those comments. I know I went with a group with Air Force Caucus to Iraq a few weeks ago, and we received some of those comments. And who is next?
Sir, I think he said, General Bradley, I think he intended for us to go down the line with that question. Actually, sir, I think for our Air Force Reserve Airmen, I don't hear complaints about treatment or benefits or pay for folks that are mobilized. They are pretty much qualified for the same pay and benefits that active regular Air Force regular component folks are acquire in those cases. There are things that some people consider not quite right or fair when you're not mobilized, some of the things, but the question was about when you're on active duty, what things are different, and there's actually very little that's different in regard to the pay and benefits.
All right, thank you, General.
Sir, from a Marine Corps perspective, I would echo the comments of my colleagues. When you are on active duty, everything is basically the same. You're all going to the same fight. When you're in a non-mobilized, non-activated status as a reserve, you are really running a parallel but kind of dissimilar life that you have chosen. And to be honest, when our Marines come, whether it's for 2 weeks or 2 days in that non-mobilized environment, they're there because they want to put on the uniform and they want to just be Marines. So there, you don't hear, if the complaint, of course, we always want more chow, we always want more bullets, always want more training, and I say that in a very serious way, because at the rate of utilization of our resources, our equipment, when these young folks come to train, they want to have the capability to do that. And they're really not talking about the kinds of things that we've been discussing here.
General McDonough.
Sir, as
General Young,
I think the overall the department's done a great job at equalizing the benefits and making our guardsmen that are mobilized feel that they are receiving equal treatment and the same degree of equipment, training, and everything else. Early on, those returning from theater that had medical problems. There was some perception there that their degree of treatment, the level of treatment, was not the same. But the Department of Veterans Affairs, everybody has worked hard that where we found those types of disparities or differences, we've worked hard to change those and change those programs to make sure that's not the case. So I would think today. I was an assistant adjutant general for 6 years and mobilized a lot of soldiers out of Ohio. And initial or early on, there were some of those perceptions. But today, the returning soldiers from the Ohio Army National Guard feel like they're treated just like an active duty counterpart.
That's good.
Thank you.
Yeah, Admiral.
Sir, I'll have to agree with the chiefs. Once on active duty, there's no very little differences. It's getting to and off active duty, a continuum of service, the ability to easily move from the reserve component to an active status and back with all the difficulties in there. We're working on that within DOD, but we've got some hurdles there. That's about the major issue I hear from my mobilized reservists.
Coast Guard.
Sir, I would echo what was just said concerning the transparency and seamlessness with which we manage our reserve components. As much as we can do to make processes the same between the two components, the better we will be. Relative to specific complaints, the most frequently heard in the past has been the discrepancy in housing allowances, but recent legislation has vastly improve that, and with the new change to the basic allowance for housing entitlement, we don't hear that complaint. But by far, that was the largest that I had heard in my travels through the Coast Guard. But with our integration, the Coast Guard reservists feel very much a part of Team Coast Guard, and they don't feel second citizens. They are right there on the front line and delivering services with great professionalism and dedication, just as their active counterparts are.
Well, thank you. Before I forget, I do want to go into this other area that I brought up previously. But you're among the busiest people in our society, and for you to sit here all these hours, I mean, we really commend you. I apologize for it, but many of you have experienced this before, and so you know what the heck it's like up here. So I just wanted to get that out. But let me get back again to the reservists, and your job is to get people to come into the reserves and to retain them, and that sort of thing. And I appreciate that. But a guy signs up for 6 years, and is still civilian, and immediately starts his education, maybe picks up the degree in 4 years, 3 years, depending on what, and then does not complete the six-year contract. And that's because this goes back, I guess, to what the chairman had brought up. In the meantime, that person has already had the education. It's cost the taxpayers an awful lot of money. You have had the use of that person for that 3 or 4 years, and probably served in Iraq or Afghanistan or whatever. In today's world, the reservists I know are just serving so much differently than they used to many years ago. The only penalty for that individual would be a non-honorable discharge. Could be general or could be something else. Is that right?
No, sir.
In the meantime, person's got the education?
No, sir. On the education,
We recently submitted our biannual report to Congress on Montgomery GI Bill, and this is the way it works. If you do not complete your obligation and you have used your benefits, we recoup the money from you. So, and in that report, we have the amount. It was just forward money, and we are recouping it now. So you cannot just take the Montgomery GI Bill and say, oops, at the end of 4 years, I want to leave. If you don't serve that time, we recoup that money from you, and we're actively doing that and have recouped amount for the people that did not meet their obligation. So you don't get off freely. You must.
Okay, you are actively recouping it, but you have to file. You have to go to court on it?
No, we just we go to them and say you owe us that amount of money, and obviously we take that out of their paycheck or they pay it, but we do recoup it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, it's good to hear. Gentlemen and lady, is there anything more? Apparently not. The chairman has had a long list of questions here. He asked me to continue receiving the answers to the one item and then proceeded to talk about a variety of items. So he has a number of others, and I know he's going to submit them to you in writing. But they're very important to him. He's spent an awful lot of time on this subject, and we discussed it at length when we discussed the budget a couple of times during the last 2 or 3 weeks. Well, I'm going to ask this question, but I think I'm going to ask you to respond to it in writing. To the reserve chiefs, I guess. Many states provide significant education benefits for members of the National Guard. However, members of the reserves do not qualify for those benefits, even though they may reside and drill in a state. Darn good point. So do you see an inequity there, and how would you remedy that inequity? Now, in the interest of time and whatnot, that's a very significant question, and hopefully, and it is a very good point. Hopefully you can think about that, maybe respond to the committee in writing, if you would, within what period of time?
We'll send it to them. Right?
Okay. They'll send it to you. All right. Thanks so much. I think we'll just go ahead and cancel the hearing, adjourn the hearing at this point in time. You've been very great, very helpful. And again, I do feel very strongly about VEEP. I may be wrong. If I am, I would appreciate your letting us know. Any comments you may have on that, you might submit to the committee along maybe with a copy to me or whatever the case may be, because I don't want to do the wrong thing. But at the same time, I just think that there's an area there that, talking about inequity, there's an area of inequity there. Thank you very much. Hearing is adjourned.